This episode is brought to you by Arden Labs Education. Sign up today to learn advanced concepts in Go, Docker, Kubernetes, Terraform, and more. Visit ardenlabs.com/education for more information.
Welcome to the Arden Labs podcast. Our special guest today, all the way from North Carolina, is Alexandra McCoy. Look, there she is. If you're not on YouTube, switch over. There she is. I can see her. Wow, Alexandra, thank you so much for hanging out with us for the next hour and a half to kind of talk about your story. I just recently found you on Twitter. And when I see a new person on Twitter, I don't know if other people do this, but I'm serious about my Twitter feed. If you notice, I only follow 305 people. I'm in the 305 area code of Miami. So I had to come up with a number, right? So I said, okay, I'm going to do 305. So I actually monitor that list fairly closely because you can get a lot of noise, especially today with their algorithms. I actually stick to just the following list now. Makes me feel like old Twitter. So when somebody like new pops up in my timeline, I start to look at what they're tweeting about. And I think I remember seeing you pop up and I was like, okay, I like her tweets. So I started following you. So yeah. I'm really excited that you're somebody new in my timeline for 2024.
Yeah, thank you. And I feel the opposite because I was wondering about what algorithms they're using these days, because everyone that I'm responding to, I'm actually not following. So depending on whatever topics I'm posting about, then, you know, if it's about a programming language or platform engineering something, then individuals that work are talking about that same topic are showing up in my feed. So for me, it's like, oh, okay, well, this person's tweets are interesting. Let me go follow them and jump in a conversation.
I mean, that's the way it's supposed to be. And old school Twitter was really good with that. But I have found if you just stick to the following, well, for me at this point, if I stick to the following list, I feel like it's old Twitter. If I go to the other list, I feel like I'm on Instagram or something, which I don't go on Instagram, but I see the kids on it. And I just feel like it's a crazy feed. This is podcast about you. I've got questions. I really don't know you at all, which is like my favorite guest because I can like, I don't have to like, fun things are going to happen here. Okay. We're going to discover some fun things. But before we start, give everybody, I call it the 2-minute elevator pitch on what Alexandra is doing today.
So right now I am a site reliability engineer at VMware. I think a lot of the industry knows about the undergoing acquisition that has closed in November. I've been at VMware for 3 years, a little over 3 years, and it's been an interesting journey. And I would say that my time at VMware has been the most transformative of my career, because I feel like I took a pause on my technical development.
Go, don't give me too much history here. No. I want to get there. You're going to ruin it there. Okay. So let's just stop there for a second here. I'm going to interrupt you a lot during this, and which I know is not socially polite, but it's going to happen. So I apologize ahead of time. So you are an SRE at VMware. That's awesome. You know, that I think I've met. Okay, let me step back. I had friends who like through Heptio mostly, and other opportunities ended up at VMware, and I've always heard positive things and they always had fun things to work on. And it's such a big company that even if you get bored after a few years, you've got other opportunities to sort of bounce around and join other projects. But talk about that.
No, I was going to say, I actually agree with that. And that's my favorite thing, because for the first time, and I also worked at IBM, which has a larger presence than VMware. The size of VMware felt perfect. And I did get to work with individuals from Heptio and Pivotal as well. It's challenging in that I don't want to say you're expected to do those things, but the culture kind of forces you to do those things. It forces you to be collaborative. It forces you to get involved in other things going on outside of just whatever it is that you're working on. And I feel like that type of culture for me has helped to pull me out of my shell a little bit more, because I was the type of person where, I just focused on whatever it is that I'm working on, and I have all of this knowledge, but how do I share that knowledge in a way that I'm also enabling others and, challenging myself to do these things and step outside of my comfort zone? So, it's definitely a special company.
Nice. Now, you don't know me at all, and for those who listen to the podcast, you know how much I disdain ops work. Like, I'm not an ops person. Don't want to be an ops person. Want to push that on anybody. I want to push that on you, Alexandra. I don't want to do ops. And you're like in the thick of it. You're an SRE. You're like dealing with fires. Hopefully not fires every day, you're in the middle of that. And I want to get that story out of you on how you ended up being an SRE. I Fascinated. I am fascinated by that role, being able to fix systems where you don't have access to changing code. In fact, the idea of changing code is not even on the playbook, right? And architecting systems and building systems so you can maintain, manage, and debug them without needing a developer. Like, that to me is not anything I want to do, but fascinating, fascinating stuff. So I don't want to go. I want to start the podcast because if not, we're going to lose the story. So I don't know if you've ever listened to any of the shows, but I'm going to give you my first favorite question. Here it is. I don't want you to think too hard. First thing that pops in your head, I want you to give me that first memory of you doing something on a computer. First memory, like how old were you, or like maybe what year was it? Actually, I got to ask you this first. What year did you graduate high school? Because I need to get a time frame for tech. So what year did you graduate high school?
2005.
2005. All right. Okay. You're just a baby. It's okay. Okay. I'm an old man. It's all good. 2005. Okay, I got to keep that in my head. 2005. It just helps us kind of get a sense of what tech was. 2005, I had my first child. Just to let you know where we're at right there, Alexandra. Okay. So first memory pops in your head of you like playing on a computer, working on a computer. What's that very first memory?
I believe I was it had to be 7th or 8th grade. I actually had I don't remember what kind of computer it was, but I do remember the floppy disk. What was it like, the A, floppy A? I forget what they were called, that you
Really?
just slid
'Cause
into the,
that's the
yes.
early 90s. You still had a flop. So you had a floppy disk machine in the early 90s.
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
Well, not the early
And
90s, the late 90s. Sorry, the late 90s.
another thing, another memory that I have that actually annoys me till this day, I don't remember what it was, but I remember when Bitcoin was like a thing, and before it was like commercial, and I forget what the name of this website was. I don't want to say like 4chan or something like that. I forget whatever it was, one of those websites that all of the techies are on. And I remember Bitcoin like being a thing before it was a thing and teetering around with it. And then I think maybe sometime while I was at IBM, like it just became this, enterprise companies are getting involved and trying to adopt it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like, if you only took something seriously back then, you wonder where that would have led you, today. So those are like two memories that I have that are near and dear to me.
So you're wishing that you had bought a Bitcoin
Yes.
back in like the late 90s, because it would be worth about $45,000
Right.
today.
Right. And I believe I did have some, but I don't know, like, where they are, what I did with them or anything like that.
Now, I
So.
hear you. I back in like 2000 and probably 11, 2012. I have to look when Bitcoin actually started doing anything. It was on my radar, and it was like 30 bucks or something to buy a coin. And I told
Right.
everybody, stay the hell away. And I still believe it. I don't have no regret buying. I don't have that kind of, that's like Vegas on steroids, that stuff for me, especially at the time, you know? So I have no regret there. Though, I don't know if you heard in the news this week, this is the week of January 11th here, 2024, the Securities Exchange Commission just allowed funds to start institutionally trading Bitcoin. I think the idea is that they're able to put them into their funds now, or they're able to trade them as a product for their customers. So mm-hmm. I never thought the government would ever do that. So did you hear what happened with their Twitter account this week too?
I did not. What happened?
Oh my God. The SEC's Twitter account got hacked. And somebody wrote a tweet saying that the SEC approved something. And the price of Bitcoin went from 45K to 48K. And then immediately they got their account back and they said this was a hack. And then the price dropped like down to like 38 or something.
It's so volatile.
And then it kind of stabled out. So now when this news came out yesterday on the Twitter account, everybody was frozen because they weren't sure right. if it was real or not. Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have a tiny bit of regret. See, I don't have those kinds of regrets at all.
Well, I think the regret is just not getting involved early enough. And it's not really a regret. It's just more so I wonder, like, you know, what would have happened. To this day, I'm not heavily involved in Bitcoin, but I do or, you know, blockchain or any of that. But I do have some, you know, crypto, and I was locked out of my Coinbase account recently because it's been so long. But, you know, I do keep some coins and try to just keep up with what the industry is doing. I do have some friends that are in the fintech space. And so I do see they post on LinkedIn and stuff like that where they're advocating for and trying to teach people how to consider crypto and kind of add it into your financial portfolio. So I'm not heavily involved, but, you know, I tinker with it a little bit. I don't put any money that, you know, I'm afraid to lose or anything like that.
Yeah, I've aged out. I tell everybody, I've aged out. I can't risk that. I can't risk it. Now, I don't think that Bitcoin or Ethereum's going anywhere just because there's so mm-hmm. much actual fiat money in it. I mean, people right. have invested so much money, like real money inside the system, that I don't think mm-hmm. it can collapse at this point. I'm not a financial person, so anybody listening to say, Bill, you've lost your mind. But yeah, I've aged out. I want to buy land, Alexandra. I don't want to buy Bitcoin. So
yeah, there's no, and we know there's nothing, you know, happening with land anytime soon. So it's a little bit more stable.
I think so. Okay, so 2005 is when you graduated high school. I want to talk about your sort of high school years. That's kind of when you start to formulate a little bit of kind of like really who you are, where your real interests are lying. My wife yells at me because we still got one girl in Danny's in junior high school, and every once in a while I'm like, Danny, it's junior high school, it doesn't matter. And she looks at me, she's like, don't tell her that. But I'm like, it doesn't matter. We're like, who cares? It's like when you start high school, and then it starts to matter, right? So what were you sort of interested in heading into high school? Were you into sports, music, or like what was Alexandra doing?
Well, I graduated from an awesome high school, Salem High School in Virginia Beach, Virginia. And the reason I say that school was awesome is because they definitely incorporated arts heavily into your curriculum, but it wasn't in a way where it compromised education. So I think as an adult now, I'm always interested in different things. I love to learn. I love to read. And reflecting back on my high school years, I was the same way. So in high school, I actually took AP psychology courses. And I thought that I was going to become this psychologist and work with at-risk youth, potentially start my own nonprofit organization. That's where I was at. And I had an awesome psychology teacher I think her name was like Miss Faulkner or whatever. She was just so awesome.
Shout out, Miss Faulkner.
Yes, shout out. And, you know, so that's what I thought I was going to do. And another thing is,
I'm curious, these questions pop in my head. I'm curious if you can remember at the time, what was it about psychology that was so interesting or fascinating? I took a class in college, right? You have to take that 101 class, and it was cool. Philosophy to me was more interesting, but I'm just curious what was it that attracted you to it at the time? Do you remember?
It's different childhood experiences. And also I have a fascination with the mind and the brain and also the body. So another thing that I was able to do in high school was also take anatomy courses. And if I didn't go to school for psychology, I wanted to go into an anatomy program, which I don't think too many colleges in the States have, like, you know, just a strict anatomy curriculum. I think one in North Carolina did at the time. So that was the reason I erred on the side of psychology. But I am just fascinated with the body, the brain, how sensitive it is. So I think
have you ever been able to see an autopsy? Because sometimes the hospitals make them public. Yes. Oh, on TV.
Yes, I have.
But not live. Person. I don't know if I could look. I don't know if I could sit even on TV. I had a brother-in-law that was doing some medical stuff, and he got to see a couple of those live.
Mm-hmm. So disclaimer, I'm originally from New York, and I did half of my high school years in New York and half in Virginia Beach. But when I was in
New York? Where in New York? Where the city upstate?
Central Islip.
Oh, you know, Mr. Kennedy is from Greenlawn, Huntington.
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
I went to Harbor Fields High School. Me and Mariah Carey, you know, we were a thing back in high school because, oh, yeah, I don't know. I went to junior high and high school with I tell everybody she was my girlfriend because nobody can, Mariah ain't going to come out and deny it. So I'm good. Mariah, if you're listening, remember how we were boyfriend, girlfriend in high school?
That is so cool. So
Islip. Okay, that's cool. All right. Yeah. So you leave Islip and go to Virginia, which is a big change. I mean, big, big, big change.
But my mom made that decision. And I know earlier you said, you know, I was a track athlete. And
I was Trace, okay, what did you run? Because I ran I had to run the mile. I was the long distance runner, the cross country, the mile, the 3 mile, which you are a sprinter, right?
Yeah, kind of, sort of. But the 100 and 200 is not my thing. I was a more of a strong sprinter. So the 400, and I can go up to the 800. I also did the 400 hurdles by force. That was not my choice at all. Go ahead.
Wait, let me tell you this, okay? First of all, I hated you guys because your races were over in a minute or less, and I had to run from anywhere from 5 minutes to like 13. So I really hated you guys because I was too short to run fast.
Confession, I did a little bit of cross country as well, so I can see why you felt that way.
but to be fair, for me the 400 is the hardest race because there's no pacing. It's an all-out sprint one time around the track, and if you're not hitting 50 seconds, like, you're, well, I don't know about at that time, at least for the men. If you weren't like sub minute, you were not even like in the race.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a hard 400 hard.
Yeah. For women, even when you say that sub minute, like, for women, you need to be sub minute to be good as well. so yeah, if you're a man and you were running a minute, like, you weren't considered good.
No. Go run long distance like Bill.
Right. Yeah, go find something else to do.
Nice. Track. I love that.
And okay. I have a funny story. So
go find something else to do. That's my favorite quote so far, Eric. Go find something else. I'm gonna write that one down because I can use that quite a bit. Go find something else to do.
The 400 hurdles, it was interesting. So I was definitely not a technically trained hurdle. So hurdler. So when I was in New York, my coach used to try to get me, shout out to Coach Creedon, my coach used to try to get me to try different things. And I remember being at a track meet and he was like, you know, have you ever thought about getting out there and doing a polo? And I was like, well, if you wanted me dead, just say that. You don't have to sign me up for polo. But no, absolutely not.
I wasn't heavy enough. I was really small in high school. I wasn't heavy enough to bend the bar.
Yeah, no, I just wasn't.
That bar doesn't bend. You can't get flipped over. Oh, you should have tried. I tried it one time. Yeah, you should have tried it.
The closest I got to jumping up in the air was high jump, and I couldn't get my hips over to hit the bar, so that just wasn't my thing.
My brain wouldn't let me do that either. My brain wouldn't let me spin upside down. But pole vault would have been good. Should have tried it.
Yeah, and
it's not too late.
It's way too late. But I definitely have a respect for pole vaulters because, you know, we don't realize when it comes to field events, like with the 400, we say that's a very mental race. We don't realize how much of the mental is required to do some of the field events. And I did do long jump and triple jump as well. But my coach in New York had me try out the 55 meter hurdles indoor. Absolute disaster. I did that about once or twice. I'm the type of person where I need to build my speed up, and I was very strong. So exploding out of the box like that was not my thing. I know how to stay in my lane. So when I moved down to Virginia Beach, I remember being upset about that. You know, I love the 4x4. I did a little bit of 4x2. Love relays. That's my favorite event. And I remember.
You still have any batons in the house? You still have any batons laying around the house? Oh, I had some batons for a long time. I finally had to get rid of them.
Yeah, no, I don't have any batons.
That's your favorite event.
It is. And the 4x4 is near and dear to me, so that's my favorite. But I remember when I moved down to Virginia Beach, I was upset with my mom, and I was like, you know, I'm not running track anymore. And she's like, what? I'm like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm leaving my team, I'm doing this. So I was in gym class, and someone that I'm friends with today, we ended up going to college together, and we're still friends to this day. We bumped into each other in gym class, and she's like, do you run track? And I'm like, yeah. And she's like, you run the 400. You look, you're a 400 runner. And I'm like, yeah, I'm a 400 runner. So she's a 100, 200 runner. And the coach had been trying to get her, some individuals graduated, and they had been trying to get her into the 400 that year. So she's like, no, I'm bringing you to the coach. And, you know, you're going to get out here and you're going to, you know, run. So, you know, I ended up joining the team. Later
that's
on,
that's because she saw your thighs, right? Like the sprinters are like the size, like my body. I'm like, I could be a sprinter from the waist up. That's about it.
We're built different.
You're just like, it's leg day every day.
Yep. And and that's another thing. I did not lift weights that much. High school and college, I have no idea how I had the career that I had lifting weights the way I did, because it was a fight, especially in college, that my coach had to put up with me, and I just was not participated in that here and there. But our coach in Virginia Beach, when you became a senior, we have a track meet, one of the last like dual meets, which is, you know, you and a rival in your division. And he was like, you know what, let's try. And the seniors, you get to pick like something that you don't want to do that you want to do. So I was like, I'll run the 100. So he was like, you know what, this is the last meet. Why don't you do, in Virginia, they do, in New York, we did the 400 hurdles. In Virginia, we did 300 hurdles. And he's like, well, Yes, it's interesting. And it's because, well, I can't even say it's because, but it's, I don't know why they do it like that. I'm not even going to try to explain that because I don't know. But we were at another school. Shout out to the young lady from Kellam Town. She was the Virginia Beach District champion in the 300 hurdles. So my coach was like, why don't you, here they go trying to, I'm in another state, another school, they're still trying to force me to do these hurdles. So he's like, why don't you do the 300 hurdles? And I'm like, but I don't want to do that. Like, just try it. This is the last dual meet. I'm a senior trying to get out of here. So I said, okay, I'll do it. So we get out there, I'm playing around, and I end up beating the girl. And I can't remember her name. So my coach says, oh, no. You're going to go to districts and you are going to run the hurdles. And I'm like, no. That's not the event. Dude, this was not the deal. You said I try it this meet, and I have a leg length difference. And so when I'm approaching the hurdles, I'm comfortable with, or I used to be comfortable, I feel like, with my right leg, not leading with my left leg. So we get to Beach Districts, and we have to do prelims and then finals. So we do the prelims, and my left leg, I'm going on a curve, and my left leg ends up being the lead leg over one of the hurdles. Instead of going over the hurdle, I slide around it, and I'm like, oh my God, but I keep running. So I don't think any of the officials caught it, except for one who threw, yes, one threw up the flag. So I knew what happened, and I get up there, and my coach was like, I was about to cry, and my coach is like, you better not cry, you better not talk about it, don't say nothing. So I was like, okay. So the officials have to go back and they have to make a decision. And only one official saw it, nobody else saw it, and it was really quick. It was very smooth. And they didn't rule me out. They didn't penalize me. So I was in the finals. So I said, all right, well, I'm gonna go ahead and I'm gonna do it. So of course so I go up and I meet with the same young lady, and oh, I tore her up on that track. Yes. So then my coach says, you going to regionals? And I'm like, no, this was supposed to be a one-time thing. So we go to regionals, I do good. I end up going to
But you
states, and
qualified for
yes,
the
and I
time.
got fourth in the state.
Imagine if you had been doing that all year.
Oh yes.
Imagine.
But
Did you ever
it was a disaster.
get to the Penn relays?
Yeah, absolutely. I still have my Penn Relays watch. So I also won conference. I went to Seton Hall University in New Jersey. We were in the Big East.
Whoa.
And
Slow down. Slow. Jumping ahead of me here. Slow down. We're still in high school here. Okay, I'm gonna pull you back a little bit. This is fascinating because I was a track runner, and the fact you went to, my sister went to Penn Relays. I wasn't good enough. But I'll after the show, I'll cry a little bit more about that later. Talk to, okay, this is good. Don't jump ahead of me here. So as you're about to graduate high school, you're an athlete, you're into the psychology, you're thinking.
And I was doing HTML on MySpace back then too. That age where you was MySpacing and didn't know you were coding.
Now, was that with a computer at home, or you have to sneak into the high school
No,
lab?
we had labs in high school, so
So you were
it
doing
was
that
at
in high
school.
school. You weren't doing it at
Yes.
home. You didn't have a computer at home.
No, I didn't. Not at that age.
Did you ever ask for a computer at that point, or you're just like,
I did
I have
not.
enough time in the
No.
lab, and so that lab time was. So what was
No.
on your MySpace page? I'm curious. You still have it?
No, I don't. I don't. Of course, pictures of me. You remember you had your top five friends. You remember
I
you
didn't
put
have a
music.
MySpace page. So I don't remember anything. I
You
wasn't
could
that
put music
cool.
on your profile. Oh, and that's also when Facebook came out. So I joined Facebook,
You're
was it
like
2005 and
person
2006?
number five. You're right on top of it right there. You still have your Facebook account? You still use it at all?
I had my Facebook page that I had since 2005 or 6. I deleted it a couple of years ago. Like, I deleted. I got tired of all of the memories popping up. So I have a Facebook page, but I got rid of my, and that was a hard decision because I'm like, you know, 2005 was when Facebook was still limited to, you had to have a college email address. And
couldn't you just create a new account and just kind of time capsule that? That's what you should have done. If I had known you, I would have said.
Oh, when you delete your page on Facebook, you can download everything. They do have a process for you to like download all your pictures, download, I think different posts or whatever it is that you have up there. So like I just downloaded my stuff and put it on a hard drive and was like, okay, the end of that chapter.
Computers right now are not on your, from high school perspective, not really on your radar
not
screen.
At all.
You're thinking all. You're going to go to, so obviously now, cause you've jumped ahead of me. You decided that you're going to go to university. You ended up at Seton Hall. And my guess is you were going to major in psychology. Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm. And I actually went for social and behavioral sciences, and then I did a minor in psychology. And here I am today.
Now, Seton Hall is in New Jersey, so you're essentially going back north.
Yes. And I was supposed to go to UNC Charlotte, so I ended up being recruited for the hurdles by a couple
Oh, really?
Of schools.
Scholarship yes. level recruiting?
Yes. Yep.
For the hurdle. And, the one race yes. that you weren't supposed to run.
Absolutely.
Yeah, there's not a lot of hurdlers out there. So I'm not shocked on that. That's a specialty. Anyway, wow. So that was surprising, right? Suddenly you're like, yeah. You got scholarship. Seton Hall gave you a scholarship for the hurdles?
Yes, yes. And I was supposed to go to UNC Charlotte. So I signed with Seton Hall at the last minute because UNC was waiting for something else. And I think I panicked because it's like, okay, you know, this is too late. And then there was something that there was a part of me that at the time that I left the North, I wasn't ready to leave the North. So, you know, I it was a part of me wanted to go back, you know, go back home or to what
Seton Hall is a great school. I Seton Hall is like, mm-hmm. That's the real deal. That's not a, you say Seton Hall, you're like, oh yeah, okay. So,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
I mean, I'm just getting a sense that you feel like you settled. It's like, if I had waited another minute, and then I would have been at UNC, and that would have been better. But mm-mm. I don't know. Maybe from growing up in the Northeast.
I don't regret it. I was recruited by UNC, Clemson, Virginia Tech, and you know, like those were the ones that were like on my radar.
Good thing you didn't go to Virginia Tech. My daughter lives out there. That town's got nothing.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have been. Sorry, Virginia Tech Hokie fans. I don't think you could have lived in Blacksburg there, but those are all big schools. That's all big D1. No joke.
Yeah, I don't regret any of it. I actually just saw my coach. My coach was there, I think, for 50 years, and I just saw him. Maybe like 2 years ago, they honored him at a basketball game at the Prudential Center. So some of his athletes from like the 80s, his athletes from like the 2000s to his country runners now all got together and stuff. So I don't regret it because you do what's best for you in that moment. And I'm a firm believer that everything happens for a reason. And sometimes some things you're not ready for. So I'm a firm believer that there was something that I needed to build upon. There was something, you know, that I needed to close in my heart. And I ended up in North Carolina anyway. So so maybe I was just not ready for it then.
I hear you. Things happen for a reason. You can't look back and second guess. And you don't want a lot of what ifs in your life. So I think you need to do things. But yeah, no, for sure. Okay, so, you know, I think you're the first person that I've talked to that probably a scholarship level collegiate, I don't know what the word is there, but that's a whole nother world. I went to university. I went to a D3 school. I went to SUNY Potsdam. I went all the way in upstate New York. And okay. I like telling this story, just especially you being an athlete. This was a D3 school we had a top D3 basketball program. Like for D3, we had a good basketball program. I played a pickup game with our like top D3 player, and it was scary. Like what this kid was doing on the basketball court was scary to me. And I said, and he's only D3. Like he can't get into D school. He can't get into D1. And I can't even like see him right now, you know?
To be honest, I downplay D1, D2, D3 because even being a track athlete, and we know with football and all things of that, like talent is talent. And I've been to events where there's a combination, like you'll have not of us competing with one another. It might be separate, but you might have a meet where there are some D3 or D2 schools. And, you know, in my opinion, it just is as good, you know, so I try not to fall into the trap of, you know, oh my God, you're D1, you're D2. I mean, it means something on paper, but there's some talent that comes out of those D2 and D3 schools.
Well, that's fair. That's totally fair. But you have, it's like a double life now in university. I mean, you got to go to university, you got to take your classes, but you lose a lot of your free time because you've got to, the other part of your life is you got to be at the sports center doing your thing, right?
Yes. And Seton Hall is an expensive school. So I went to school with a lot of people who come from money and, you know, I didn't come from that environment. So I also worked while I was in college as well. When I reflect on it, I do not know how I did what I did. And I used to commute. I commuted into Manhattan because I used to work for Nike, and I would commute.
Whoa. The job you had wasn't on campus?
No, I didn't have an on-campus job. I used to take the bus down to the train station, take the train down to 57th Street in Manhattan. And if it was nice or funds were like, if something was going on, I would take the train into 32nd Street. And then I would walk up to 57th if it was like summertime, because I like to, I love the city, so. Yes,
I don't know enough. I have no idea. What is the commute on that? I don't know how far away Seton Hall is from me. That's like, well, my brain is saying it had to be at least a half.
No, if you drive, it should be about 20 something miles, but we know New York traffic is New York. So if you drive, it could be about, you know, like 30 to 40, 45 minutes. If you're taking the train, you got to know what time your trains are going to be at what platform.
Oh my God.
And yeah, so it's longer than an hour and change commute.
My guess is you use that time to do homework or something.
Actually, no, I should have been, but that's not what I did. I used to read. I would read or take a nap.
Yeah. What? Okay, so. I could have an entire show just on that alone. Okay, so see, you know, here's something that's interesting though. When I went to university the first couple of years and my schedule wasn't packed, I did really poorly. But because I had to play catch up in the last 2 years, I really packed my schedule and I did better. So I think sometimes when you're super busy like that, your schedule's packed, you just tend to focus more because you just don't have a lot of time in between to slack.
Yeah, I would say that that's pretty accurate. And what I've learned is that when I have like things to do, like I'll structure my schedule. It's because you know you have to get these things done. So I'm more liable to structure my schedule appropriately. I've also found that the closer I live to work, the increase in the chances of being late. And the further I live, because it's like, you know, you have to do these things. So you're not going to leave as much room for error. And I don't know, like sometimes when I look back, I'm like, God bless me. Because he was definitely by my side every step of the way, because I don't know how I did. I don't know how I did. And I enjoyed it. I don't know. It wasn't like I was crying about it. Like, I loved getting up. Like, I'm not a morning person, But, you know, if I get up and start my day, I function throughout the day a little bit better, even though I don't like getting up in the morning. But, you know, once I get up and I get going and like I get into the, would get into the city, like, I mean, I just enjoyed it. And I still had a social life in college as well. So it didn't really like compromise anything.
I'm guessing that you didn't have classes on Tuesday and Thursday, and that's when you would go work at Nike and then come back for practice. Is like scheduling wise, you couldn't just go off in the middle of the day.
I didn't work all 4 years. It was later in my career. So like the summer I would work, and I didn't like to weight lift. So like I would do cross country, or take like one summer I did like aquatics with took an aquatics course to just like keep my body in shape. So like in the summers I would work and then just do that. And then when I went back to school, it was more so like, okay, I'll come in on the weekends and structure it around my courses. Yeah. So
how did you get this job? Like, what was this job? Because that's interesting.
I worked on your running floor. And so my sophomore year, I actually bartended in college. And then my junior and senior year, I worked at Nike. And when I went to interview, and I worked in their sales department, but I worked on the running floor. So I dealt a lot, like we had something called Run Club. And that's where a lot of the customers can come up to the store. And if they want to try out the latest, you know, shoe or whatever it is, we would have like, you know, a certain amount of shoes that would be available. They could participate in Run Club, try the shoes out. So we could be, if you were doing Run Club, you could go out on a 3 mile, 5 mile, 7 mile run at work. And that was what you were getting paid to do. And then I worked on the sales floor. And then we also did something called like pop-up shops, which I'm seeing in like North Carolina and stuff these days. You see a lot of the pop-up shops going on, but that was something that I did back in college as well. And one of the requirements was us to be versed on the running technology. So we had to be able to like break down all of the technology in a shoe. Nike's known for their dry fit technology when it comes to their apparel. So it was perfect for them.
You were a scholarship track runner, like game over. Yes. You must have had access to free shoes, and you must have gotten those spike shoes for track, right? Remember the spike shoes? Yes. They were so expensive that I got lucky. My family didn't have money, but my mom always found a way to buy me what I needed. She bought me in high school one of those shoes. And there was a girl on our track team, and every time she had a race, we had the same size foot. She'd go, "Can I borrow your shoes?" And I'd be like, "Yeah, here." She was better than me. The shoes, I think at some point I just gave her the shoes because she was much better than me. And she was
wearing my shoes.
I was like, "Please, please, because I'm making these shoes look bad." And she was like a sprinter anyway. At some point, I just gave them to her. My mom's like, "Where's your shoes?" I said, "Don't ask."
Yes, that's funny. So, but yeah. And then for me, a big thing was also like we Nike treated their employees very well. I think when I reflect, like now I'm big on culture and I'm able to vocalize it. But whenever I look back on my career, I think the start of me getting a feel for, you know, what type of environment I wanted to work in and things of that nature started with Nike. Like you may not have been best friends and stuff like that, but, you know, everyone was fairly, you know, close. They treated us well in terms of like, you know, if we wanted to, you know, employee discounts, in other words, but they treated us very well. And I worked at what they call, because we have like Nike outlets everywhere, but Nike has like Nike towns, which are like heavy on marketing. You have celebs that'll come in. Sometimes they'll have events and shut down the store.
What's the biggest celeb you met? Who's the biggest celebrity you met?
Denzel has come in. Denzel, Spike Lee, did not meet, LeBron James came in, did not meet him, but he took over our little floor. I think it was Serena, not Venus. I think Serena. And that's like about it. But
Tiger, they just dropped his contract after 25 years.
He's come in for like events, but we also had to remain like professional. So we can't, you know, like just run up to them the way you want to. But sometimes depending on like if they're working your floor and they're coming in to, you know, to for whatever the case may be, then, you know, you'll get to say hello or help them or whatever the case may be.
No, you got, you always got to be cool. Like you got to act like I don't really care. You're here. In the back of your head, you're like, oh, my God. Oh, my God. And then in front, you're like, eh, it's nice. It's cool to meet you. You know, it's nice to meet me, too.
Yeah. Yeah, so
okay, that was like, I got to pull you back. I got to pull you back. I got to pull you back here. We're like 45 minutes in and I'm enjoying this conversation. But I got to get you back into some tech here. So university, did you end up graduating with the degree in psychology what was the that was the minor, right? What was the major?
So you
finished that degree. You didn't want to change it at all. The Nike experience didn't make you think about business.
I had the nerves because we're a liberal arts school, so we have to take a massive amount of credits in order to graduate in comparison to some other schools. And, you know, you have people that are like, oh, take art, like you do this. I had the nerves to go do like a business minor too.
So you did?
Yes, I did. Yes, I did.
And you still enjoyed your time there. You partied a little bit and, my God, you're like a machine. Are you sure? I mean, that's...
Yeah. I have no idea.
That's a lot. As you're now graduating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where's your head? You're already working at Nike. Is your plan to like continue to work at Nike, or are you going to go find a job in this field doing social work? No. I think.
So my first job was in North Carolina that aligned with my degree, and I was working in the criminal justice space. So pretrial coordinator. Think about probation. But pretrial release differs in that it's saving or conserving dollars in space while someone is awaiting trial if it's a nonviolent offense. So I did that for a couple of years.
That's like what, 2009? You graduate in 2009?
I started there in 2010 is when I started 2000. There.
But you had never been in an environment like that. Like this is an entirely new environment, right? Even in school. Mm-hmm. I imagine maybe you got to go to the courthouse a little bit, but like this is a whole nother world. Oh, you did. Okay.
Yes,
so it wasn't foreign to you when you took the job because you were already.
No.
You were already seeing this.
So I like to leave it as I did get to use my degree for a little bit. I did. And we had.
So you did. You did 2 years of this.
Yep.
You did 2 years of this at the. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Yeah. So, yeah, talk more about that, because this is a...
So my job, it was ran by a director, and she was never at work. So it was me and the administrative assistant that did most of the work. And
was she playing golf every day? I mean, she's not listening.
I don't know, but I was very passionate about it. And a part of our program was to partner with our local community college, partner with judges, magistrates, and local lawyers in the district attorney's office in order to take them through the process of becoming eligible to qualify for the program, getting them into the program, and coming up with stipulations that would put them on the right track to reduce recidivism.
What was the purpose of the program again?
To minimize recidivism. And then also save the money in the state dollars instead of, so whenever someone.
What does that word mean? I've never heard that word before.
So the likely to relapse into, the likelihood of relapsing back into a life of crime.
Oh,
so
okay.
There's statistics around that. If someone is used to live in a certain way or certain behaviors, and a part of the criminal justice system is we think you commit a crime, you go to jail, you do your time. And if we put you out into society and you have these blemishes on your record, society is going to judge you. Your record is going to limit to what you have access to. And then we expect someone that committed a crime to go back out and just live this perfect life and not commit crime again.
Especially if they have a felony. No, once you have a felony, nobody wants to hire you. Right. And you wonder why they're going back to doing what they're doing. They have no choice.
Right. So our program, for one, and then when someone is sitting in a cell, you spend more of the taxpayers' dollars. So our program assessed whether or not they had a stable residence. Whatever their crime was, let's say it was a drug offense, they would have to undergo drug testing as a part of their
nonviolent. Release. As long as it was nonviolent.
And I'm not going to say that we've never had someone that had a nonviolent charge, but that was the part of working with the district attorney's office and the judges to kind of isolate those anomalies and, you know, and see if they were eligible. And I worked with a lot of individuals from the sheriff's office, and I was the only person that did not carry a gun or anything like that. And I feel like I had a wonderful relationship with the majority of the individuals that I, you know, had to supervise. And I say that to say I've seen some stuff and I have my opinions about our criminal justice system. And it's not pretty. My opinions are not pretty. But I can say I never felt threatened. Even, you know, sometimes being the last person, not sometimes, most of the time, being the last person at work and having to lock up and make sure individuals get to where they need to be, never felt threatened or anything like that. I believe that, especially when it comes to criminal justice population, when you're used to a certain lifestyle and you approach someone with hostility or you treat them according to the assumptions that they have about how they're going to be treated, that's the behavior that you're going to get. But when you show them something different and you're able to provide them with something different, they're going to respect that and they're going to respect you and they will treat you differently. So I think that was one of my most rewarding jobs.
But what takes you out of it after 2 years? You got my daughter went to university for journalism, ended up in criminal justice. Now she's in Blacksburg working, mm-hmm. I think, for the police doing, I don't know if she's doing, not that program, but she kind of, she's brand new. She's just started a full-time job this year. So it'll be interesting. And I'm going to have you two talk in 2 years and see where you're at. But what decided after 2 years that you didn't want to be doing that anymore?
I'm going to be careful about what I say, but it was the director that I worked for. If not for her, I love the journey that I've went on. I love where I've gotten to in my career. But I often reflect on that and wonder what would have happened if, you know,
You had the right person in that position. The right person was in that position and you had stayed. Where would you be today?
Right. And to give an example on why I say I'm going to reserve some judgment, when you work in the system, there's a lot of stereotypes. But when you get to see some of those stereotypes firsthand, I've literally cried in court before because there's someone that you knew did well. You knew they have a family. You knew they were trying. You knew everything was circumstantial and they were given, you know, the unfair side of things. And then you see someone that has money, that has a family with a reputation and did something that it was absolutely vile and disgusting, but it gets covered up. And that person gets, you know, the blemish wiped from their record and they get to go on and live their life as if nothing happened. Stuff like that. And then hearing some of the things or the interactions with some of the lawyers. And it's like, you're a lawyer and you're doing this and you're representing this individual who doesn't have the same access as you. But in my opinion, y'all are both the same. But because you have privilege, because you have the connections, you're working this job and you're representing someone and judging someone when behind the scenes, you're no better than them. That coupled with working for a director that if she was having a bad day, we could revoke their release. And I've worked with judges with, and if that happens, it would be in the middle of the night, you know, any time of day. So if you're upset or there's some misunderstanding, then they have to go back to jail. And that should not be used as a control mechanism. And a lot of authority and power was abused, in my opinion, at that time. And it just did not sit well with me. So
and you felt powerless.
Right.
And you feel powerless because you're just so new in the system. And if you say anything, it's just going to be worse on you.
Right. And that did happen to me. So what ended up happening, because I'm very vocal and I'm not afraid to speak up. And what ended up happening was I felt like they were trying to put me in a position to fire me. And in the 2 years that I worked there, I used to take count. I had over 10 coworkers in a 2 year period. So what ended up happening was someone would come in, they couldn't handle it, or she would fire them for something stupid. And then they would end up leaving or getting fired. So then someone else would come in, and then I would have to train them. And I would have to do the work until we got someone else in, and then train them, and then go through that same process again. But I always, I was taught, the administrative assistant, she was awesome. She was awesome. And I'm like, me or her should have been the director. But, you know, the friendship, the colleagueship, whatever you want to call it, got me through those times. And but it got to the point where I felt like when they hired someone that she felt comfortable or less threatened by, that was when they tried to get rid of me. And I fortunately, and at the time I was like, what, 20, 23 years old. At that time, I used to print out all my emails, anything, any conversation.
So you learned the email real quick. You learned how
early
how,
on.
That's a weapon. Yeah.
Yep.
I learned that so too early on.
They tried to schedule a surprise meeting so that I could not have my stuff in that meeting. And the director walked with me over and was like, well, what is it called out here? Like the county manager or something like that, whoever runs the county. I forget his name, but they scheduled a meeting and she pretended while we walked over there that she didn't know why we were going over there. And then when we got into the meeting, it was her, the HR director, the director of my program, and the county manager just unload all of this stuff. And I didn't have any, like, I didn't have anyone to, you know, to advocate. It was me in here trying to defend myself at 23 years old against all these people who have this reputation in this county. And I was like, wow, you know. So when they did that, it was a matter of, do I want to sit here and continue to do this, or do I just want to go on and, you know, and flourish the way that I know I can? And I remember when I left that meeting, because I was a, you know, all of the judges and everyone would rather deal with me than her. And the clerk of courts, like I had some individuals over there, like, because I was the baby. So, you know, they like when I got out, I remember just running down to the clerk's office and crying. And they were like, what happened? You know, what happened? What happened? And I was just like, you know, I didn't understand why why they did that, you know, and I didn't care to understand why. But when you really enjoy something and you know that you're coming from a good place, it's, you know, it's just, it's negligent, it's nasty, and it's hurtful. So I just started applying to jobs, and a big part of my job was working with GPS software and technology. And the company that we used was based in Raleigh. And I was very cool with one of the guys that used to have to come out to our county. So when they were implementing their technology with the probation office for the state, it was like, well, why don't I train you so I don't have to come all the way out here, and then you can work with, you know, everyone. You could work with the probation office, and then you can.
Yeah, you're a subject matter expert.
Right. So let's do it. So, you know, it was just weird because I'm like, you have this one person who has this reputation, but because she's connected with all of these people, even though everybody knows you're the one doing the work, you're the one, like, even the judges are like, y'all can't keep calling me in the middle of the night to revoke someone's release over something so silly. Like the judges say, it's like, you know, it got really bad. So, and I think when that happened, it was the universe telling me that it's time to move on, because I ended up on my first software project after that. And it was with the state of North Carolina, and it was so bad that I took a temp job. And everyone thought I was crazy, like, you're gonna go and take a temp job? But I was, the state has their own temp agency, and they bring on people. And I ended up staying with them for 2.5 years until I was ready to move on. So I think.
But that was good experience, because that was almost like a consulting sort of experience, mm-hmm. right? Walking into different places and doing mm-hmm. what you were doing.
Right. And that was how, in my opinion, that was how I got my foot in the door at IBM. So
talk to me about that, because at the end of your time with government work, now we've got to be talking about 2013. Like IBM is what, 2014?
IBM was 2015. And 2013, I went with the state of North Carolina. I was working for the Department of Health and Human Services. And I started out traveling. So they had an initiative where they were releasing a product called Curum. Now, Curum was a company that was acquisitioned by IBM, and I didn't know that when I joined. And you want to know, let me tell you how the world works. When I worked at Nike Town and I used to go to lunch, I never realized that the IBM building was right next door. So we had the Trump Tower and we had IBM. And I used to go and have lunch in the Trump Tower sometimes, and they had a little bar, so you go over there. Or if we were like getting food from a food truck, we used to go sit downstairs at the IBM building. The universe, and this is in what, 2008, 2009, the universe works in mysterious ways. So IBM acquisitioned this company. It's a platform that unifies your different programs that are offered by the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Social Services. So when you think about Medicaid, you think about food stamps, you think about child care programs, other welfare or monetary programs, they have a platform where the software for all of these different programs are built into the platform, and you can configure it according to your state's policy. You can utilize whatever parts of the system that you need. If you want to just do Medicaid, you could just do Medicaid. If you want to implement it for all of the programs, then you can implement it for all of the programs. And they were rolling it out. North Carolina has 100 counties. So they were rolling it out across the state in phases. So initially, you know, I worked with GPS technology and software. I worked at Nike with running technology, dry fit apparel. So I try to use that to my advantage. And what we were called, I forget what we were called, but we had to go on site to the different social service office. We had to learn the software, go on site. And we did like a little bit of like troubleshooting and stuff like that, some training, a bunch of everything. You were just
Was this installed on-prem? The software was installed on-prem? It wasn't cloud yet, was it?
It wasn't cloud. I forget how they did it. If it was cloud, because it was like web application. So it was,
They probably had their own data centers.
And then mainframe was still a thing and all of that jazz. So our job was just to know how to use it. And then because I'm coming from the government side of things, it was more so understanding the policy. So that was our job. And we had individuals who had, you know, some extensive legacy knowledge as it relates to economic program policy. And that was our job, to stay on site and act as, you know, just this subject matter expert for policy, as well as how to use the application, and then get them to our help desk teams whenever they needed to. So eventually,
I mean that was using both. It was all that government experience you had with the tech stuff that you're enjoying.
Yeah. I enjoyed it, and going to different counties, getting to see different parts of North Carolina. It was interesting. Were some cities more boring than others? Absolutely. I have appreciation. You know, I could find beauty in all different locations.
But how long would you have to stay on site? A month?
We would be, I think the longest was a month. The longest that I've done like on site was like a month, but we would go home on the weekend. So it wasn't just like you were staying out.
So they put you in one of these like extended stays.
We had state vehicles. We had certain hotels that they partnered with, and we would stay at, you know, those hotels. You have a vehicle. If you drove your personal vehicle, then you would just expense your mileage, and then you got a certain.
All right. So now I got to ask you a personal question. Did you have a significant other at the time you're doing this, that you're away for? So it was a good time to be doing that.
And I have somebody to say. Yeah. Where you going? We ain't coming home.
When you coming home? Exactly. You didn't have any of that stress. To go with it. Did anybody that you worked with that did this job must have had some of that, right? You didn't have to deal with that.
Yeah, we had people who had families, spouses, all different ages, generations. And a lot of what I did appreciate about that project was there were people with all different backgrounds. So it was almost like it was a passive opportunity for some individuals to get their foot in the door. So some had, you know, experience and some didn't. And I'm, you know, I don't know who will watch this or tune in or whatever we want to say, but there was someone on that project, and we're still friends this day. She had a family and she was a chef, and she had her own business, and her and her husband, something happened with his career and they needed some money. So she ended up just taking that job. Well, she works, and I mean, awesome work ethic, awesome individual. And she works at Red Hat now and has been there for some years. So I think that was the universe giving individuals an opportunity to transition to another phase in their life. And if you took advantage of it, then you took advantage of it and you're in a good place now. And if you didn't, then you just went on and did whatever was best for you, you know, at that point in time in your life.
Now here's the real burning question, because I traveled extensively for 3 years. I got to the point where I didn't want to eat out anymore, like forced myself to cook at home at some point, because if I walked into one more restaurant, I was going to like shoot myself. I mean, that's sometimes the big problem with all this traveling, right? Were you cooking in that hotel room, or you have to go?
Okay. So I come from family of folks that could cook. We do some Southern cooking. I always tell people I'm a Southern New Yorker, but we do some cooking, and I enjoy it, but life sometimes gets in the way. I have an affinity for eating out and dining. If I could make a career out of traveling and trying different restaurants, I absolutely would. I'm not a fan of fast food. And at that point in time, like I'd rather go out to a restaurant and spend money on food that's cooked appropriately. Right. Versus, you know, going and get something. Like, do I do that now? Like, I slip up. I have fast food more now than I did back then when it was just me eating out. So, and, you know, so I still say, even though I'm eating out, I'm still going to be choosy about where I'm eating out. And if I have to pay a couple more bucks because, you know, it's a healthier option, then that's what I'm going to do. And I enjoy eating out. So. So I did a lot of that.
That's fair. I remember on one trip, I had a friend in that town, and he invited me over to his home for like a meal that he cooked. And I think I cried at the table at that point. It was like, it had been like almost over a year that I had sat down at a table and had a meal. And I like I was hold, and I don't cry, but I'm like holding back tears. I'm like, oh my God, it's so good. Oh man. You end up at IBM because IBM is, as you said, acquired
They acquired Curum. It was called Curum. Mm-hmm.
They acquired it and you went along over at IBM, which to me is a big deal. You get in a company like IBM, I mean, you could be, what year is that? How old are you? What year is that when IBM was 2015, you said?
So I don't know. I was like in my later 20s or something like that. I had to be like 20s. 26, 27, somewhere around here.
You must be thinking like, this is it. I mean, I'm an IBM. I'm back in the city where I started. This is amazing. This is going to be everything right here.
Let me throw a twist on you. IBM, they told me no so many damn times. I applied so many times to IBM. I really learned before they acquired that company, and I didn't join them through an acquisition. They just finally told me yes. And I firmly believe that they said, you know what? Let's just tell this girl yes. Cause if she sends another application, and I think Jenny Rometty was the CEO at this time. Like, I wouldn't be surprised. She's like, I'm going to go down there and choke this girl myself. And she submits another application. But
let's just give her a job. Get her out of her hair.
So let me put a twist on it. So while I was at working with the state, I think that was my opportunity because I didn't know anything about the tech space. That was really where, because I had an interest in staying there, software projects are usually fast paced. There's change that goes on. And let me throw out another thing, like I'm ADHD. And the way my mind is, like back then, I didn't have a good grasp on where it was that I was trying to get to. So I was very flighty. And while I was at the state, it gave me the opportunity to really sit and dissect what it means to be in tech and, you know, what is a software project? What roles are on a project? When we think about tech and you don't know anything about it, we automatically go to developers. We don't think about, you know, different roles that have to support these projects. So back then I wanted to be a business analyst. I'm like, I want to be a business analyst. I love learning about I like learning about technology. I like, well, how do we implement this? How do we do these things? How do we make it work? So I started applying to jobs. Of course, I fell into that. I didn't even go to school for that. I didn't have that much experience. You want to come in and be a business analyst. Then I'm on a project and I'm watching all of these people that I'm training go off, get these roles, make all of this money. And I'm like, I'm training. So why won't anyone give me a job? So I ended up taking a contract and going to Syngenta. And Syngenta is an agricultural company. They're also in North Carolina, and they're known for their corn seed. So I take a role working with, and contracting is big down here in North Carolina, or I don't know if it is now, but back then it was a big thing. And I stayed there for a couple of months, and I went as a business analyst and classified as like a scientific analyst. I have no idea what that is. But I love. There's a part of me, people who know me personally, they know there's a nerdy side to me. So working with scientists, they're very passionate about what they do. And when you talk to people who love what they do, the experience communicating with them and working with them and learning about what they do is very pleasant. So it was very pleasant while I was there. It was a group of young, we were in this area that was like Gen X, where they were starting to hire like young people, because Syngenta is like a Swiss company, very, you know how that corporate culture could be. So Gen X was supposed to be these young individuals that are, you know, we're doing things differently.
Was it like living in the Big Bang Theory? you watch that show?
I know it, but I don't watch it.
Now you got to watch a few episodes and get back to me.
Yeah, so it was very nerdy, but in a good way. And again, I think earlier I mentioned anatomy. And while I was in New York, one of my favorite classes was a biology class that I took where we actually did a lot of dissecting and stuff like that. So, and learning about genetics and things like that. So working at Syngenta, like when I, that first week that I got there, it was revisiting all of these different topics, because I was always like, we do all of this stuff in school and then we get out here in the world and you don't use half of it, you use a small percentage. So revisiting genetics was huge, because learning about GMO, how we go around saying GMO, but what the actual definition of GMO and crossbreeding and all of that. So I was working on a Hadoop migration project. Like they were migrating data from like the legacy Oracle database setup and started to take advantage of Hadoop. And it was very pleasant. But what ended up happening is, one, it was a contract. Two, I was still finding myself. And although I like some of the individuals that I work with, the culture there, I felt like I didn't like fit in, and in some areas wasn't necessarily welcome. And there were some other individuals that experienced the same thing. So IBM, after I had went through rounds of interviews with IBM, whatever, and I just took this contract job because I wanted to go in. So while I'm there, IBM is like, oh yeah, we'll take you for this role. And I'm like, what? You guys waited till what? So I ended up picking my stuff up and moving to Western Maryland. And everyone thought I was crazy.
Maryland? Hold on here. I got to bring up a map, because I can't even think about Western
Cumberland. Look up Cumberland.
Oh my God. Western Maryland. What is, like, you're on the edge of West Virginia over there. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. No, let me put icing on the cake. IBM had a data center.
What was it called? Cumbersome?
Cumberland.
Cumberland, Maryland. Let's see.
And Kaiser, West Virginia. Look up both of those. That's where I was.
Oh my God.
But let me put the kicker on it. I enjoyed it. I did not like being away from family and friends, but I enjoyed it up there. One, because when I moved to North Carolina, we don't really get winters. And West Virginia reminded me of the winters that my childhood winters.
there's snow happening there.
Yes.
How far away are you from Pittsburgh there?
Pittsburgh was a
like 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. I went up to Pittsburgh. I'm a football fan, so I did get the opportunity.
That's a 2-hour drive.
Oh, 2 hours. Okay. Yeah. So I went up to Pittsburgh during a Steelers versus Miami game, and in the winter, and it was a pleasant experience. Pittsburgh is very nice, and they have good beer.
I've never been to Pittsburgh. I've been to Philadelphia and the other, you know, east side of these states, but I haven't been to the west side of these states.
Yep. And so, let me tell you,
driving
into Cumberland was absolutely beautiful.
A lot of mountains.
Mountains.
Your car better be able to handle 30 degree plus. I drove from New York to West Virginia one time in my Datsun 310 GX. This engine was small. And I got to West Virginia, but on the way home, I almost didn't make it up a hill. I was in first gear trying to get up a hill. And I really thought that I was going to need a tow truck. Like, those mountains are not a joke. It's not even like it's steep. They can go for a quarter to a half a mile on that incline.
It is pretty. In the fall, it is so pretty. And they have a lot of bike trails and walking trails. And
so how long were you there?
I was up there for, I think, 2 years. My goal was to do 3 years, but I couldn't. I was like, no, I'm ready to go. I'm ready to go. And then
But that
also,
so IBM had a big complex over there, is what you're saying.
so I was in IBM public sector, and they had, this is where their Watson technology was starting to kick off. And in Kaiser, West Virginia, there was a naval base. And a very, I come from a military family, but my parents were the ones that didn't go into the military. So I forget what was special about this base, but that was where IBM had their data centers. And whenever they went to bid on their government projects, it was like a key selling point. So we had to go up there. Some projects you had to get clearance for. You had to go through these extensive background checks and all of this other kind of crazy stuff. So I was bored out of my mind with government projects. So I was searching through like our project database, and I found that they had Curum projects. So I had to go through, because Curum was still like government, but it wasn't like considered under the division that I was in. And I had to get permission, because I was like, I have experience with this. I know I like this. I wanted to come to IBM to work on this. So let me start working on these sorts of projects, and then see if I could build, relationships and navigate in that direction. So they ended up giving me permission, and I'm the type of professional where it's like, I'm gonna go off and do what I want to do, but you don't have to worry, because no matter what I'm doing, I'm working. And I start traveling out to Missouri in Jefferson City and working on projects out there for about 2 weeks, and then come back home for 2 weeks, and then going back
You
out there to
drive out
work.
to Missouri from there?
No, absolutely
No,
not. I work for
I
IBM. If
was
they
gonna
have me
say.
driving.
I know. I was gonna say you made it sound
And
like
let me tell
you were driving
you,
like 20 hours.
what I learned is, what I learned back in was like in the tech space, IBM professionals were classified or considered to be like the bougie professionals. So no, absolutely no one is driving to to Missouri City. We were very well
You
taken
had to
care of.
upgrade your wardrobe though, right? Like you had to
Yes, I
wear
did.
professional. Like that I mean
Yes.
that cost a little money once you got hired there. You had to buy clothing.
And I did a brief, because I was working on my master's. So even before that, also did a brief like internship as like a product specialist at the IBM location in RTP. So whenever I did that, and that was while I was working on my master's,
I
the
like how
one
you
thing I
just throw
learned.
that in. Oh yeah, and when I was working on my master's,
I did do
I'm
that,
nonchalant, just gonna
and
throw that in there. What were your
me
master?
tell you,
What
this girl,
was this master's degree gonna mean?
information technology. So when I got into the space, it was like, this is what I want to do, and I'm gonna go ahead and do this and work.
You're
And
nonstop. You're just nonstop. You're nonstop. You always got 3 or 4 eggs.
And
Or
that's
balls in the air there. Wow.
the problem.
But you're finishing
So,
stuff. No, that's not fair. It's only a problem if you start and don't finish, but you're finishing things. So it's not a problem.
So, and I brought
What
that up
school are you going to
because
for the masters? What school are you
I
going to for the
did I did it
masters?
all I did it online
You did
because
online. You did online. Okay.
yes, because I started at the end of my journey with Department of Health and Human Services. I had a long conversation with the recruiter because I was so scared to do this. And I went from there, was worked on it while I took the contract at Syngenta, did the internship at IBM, the contract at Syngenta, and then took the business analyst role at IBM for like a full-time role. And I completed it while I was in that role. And again, another point of my career where I'm like, I have no, or life where I'm like, I have no idea how I did. I don't think about it. It's just either I want to do this or I don't. And sometimes you have to take those steps in order to get to that next step. And so I did that, but I brought up that role at IBM because the one thing that was special to me about them was similar to Nike. When you come in, yes, we want you to know your job. Yes, there are going to be some things that you don't know, and these are the things that we want to teach you. But another thing that we want to teach you is what our culture is like, what our expectations are of our professionals, what expectations we have of you as a professional when you're interfacing with our external clients. So you mentioned like switching up the wardrobe and like the whole like legit consulting persona. And I was already prepared for that, having that internship experience with them. And it was important because IBM is one of those companies where, you know, engineers are allowed to be engineers, but when it comes to the business side of things, this is how we do things. And we're not going to come in and judge you for, you know, any of these other things, but we're going to come in, we're going to teach you, you're going to learn about our history, you're going to learn about our values. Like, you come into companies and they say these are the things, and IBM is like, no, these are the things, but we want to first make sure that you understand these things. Like, we literally carry cards that had our mission and our values that you could keep in your wallet, keep in your book bag to remind you of those things. So it was the perspective that I have on what it takes from, or how you should present yourself from a professional standpoint on the business side of things is heavily, heavily impacted by my experience with that company.
In a positive way. Like, if you're going to start a business, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It, one day when you start your business, these are things that you're going to make sure are in place.
It was very fun, but, and then I shifted. So that's, I conceived another, factor in me transitioning back to North Carolina was where I was at IBM when I was pregnant with my daughter. And I moved into IBM Cloud because they had a team here in North Carolina and I needed to be back in North Carolina. So I reached out to the manager because for some reason I could not submit the application. And I mean, I was interviewing North Carolina, interviewed at SAS at like 37 weeks pregnant. Don't know how I did that. Like, I was literally coming back, like, I gotta get back before I have this baby, which was another factor, being pregnant and trying to interview. People don't want to say it. And yes, we have these values that, you know, it's non-discriminatory, but based on my experience interviewing with, it absolutely was. It absolutely was, being a pregnant mom and, you know, trying to get in somewhere. IBM, I started with them after I had my daughter, and I did my maternity leave with IBM, and the manager transferred me in into IBM Cloud. And baby, as much as I love, even when I was at Syngenta, you know, we had to get dressed, but when I got in and I got in, you know, back on the tech side, and we could put on some jeans and a regular shirt, I was so happy. I was so happy. Like, I love to dress up, but you know, when you're working on certain things, you just want to be comfortable. You just want to be comfortable and get the job done.
We got like another 10 minutes here, and your story is actually fascinating, but I gotta get us over to VMware. So you're like, you want to work at IBM forever. You're applying. You get in, you get now over to IBM Cloud. Oh, right. Like life is really mm-hmm. good. And now you're not at IBM anymore. So talk to me about.
Okay, so I'm gonna try to keep that simple. In my mind, I would retire from IBM back then. In my mind, if I left, I would make it back to IBM. It didn't matter. The biggest factor was, again, having my daughter. My own values changed. That was where they. Also, by the time I got back to North Carolina, that was where they also got rid of, they made an RTO. So everyone had to return to office. And I was living outside of, which I'm still not in the Raleigh area, but I was living outside of an hour outside of Raleigh. So let me. So I have to get right. But let me put the kicker on it. Let me tell you what my schedule was. Get up 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, be out the door between 5:30, 6 o'clock, drive out to RTP. Mind you, this is with a newborn, and get to work around, 7 o'clock, a little bit before 7 o'clock. My team is not even in yet. They don't get in until, 9, 10 o'clock, and run down to the pump room, breastfeed, go down to the cafeteria, get breakfast, get back upstairs, start working. By time lunch, I do my walk with my team to go down to Starbucks.
So you had your baby with you in the office?
No, she was at home with her dad, and she went to daycare.
Oh, home. You were pumping to make sure you had milk the next day.
Right. And I, when I did drop off, I would leave the milk at the daycare so that she would have milk for the next day. And then I'd get home at night and I would pump and feed her or whatever.
Felt like a robot at that point.
The universe was saying, let me see what you're made of. And I did that for a year, and I have no idea how I did it. The first day back to work, I was caught in the traffic out here. It took me 2.5 hours to get to work. I her dad called me on the phone because I had told him, let's try, because I didn't go back to work till she was 5 or 6 months pregnant. And I said, we need to, because I was doing the majority of the feeding. I said, but we need to introduce the bottle to her. When I left that day, he called me. She was hollering on the phone. She would not take the bottle, all this stuff. I was driving to work in traffic in tears. My hormones were still not regulated. And I'm like, my baby is I'm a terrible mom. She's screaming. This is not good. And I did that for a year.
Except she's not going to starve herself. So.
Right, right. And once she would get to the sitter, the sitter was like, you just get her up in the morning, get dressed, bring her here. I'll feed her. So that was how the leave the milk there started and all of that. So once we got into the routine, things were fine. The biggest part was, so one, that was a lot for me. And then two, I started with open source and I was working on IBM Cloud. They restructured the division that we were in. And it was me and another person that had started, his name was Alex as well. And we started working on Kubernetes. And this was before, because Kubernetes was donated to open source in 2015. And when I was in West Virginia or Maryland, IBM Cloud was still Bluemix. And that was where I was introduced to it, but I didn't understand what I was being introduced to. And then when I moved to this team, we started teetering with the Kubernetes stuff and I just enjoyed it. And they ended up restructuring our team and they moved me and him to focus on the Kubernetes part of the platform as well as the Kubernetes part. And I started trying to get involved in open source and a recruiter reached out to me and it was with a startup and the startup's called Diamante. And they did more on-prem work. And that on-prem part was for enterprise accounts that wanted to utilize Kubernetes that were into the whole container orchestration migration, but they wanted to use their own data centers. So their appliance virtualized the storage and networking aspects of things. And then you had this plug and play Kubernetes environment right on premises. So I made that decision for one, the commute was too much for me. And then two, I was like, I really like Kubernetes. I'm really enjoying this open source. I want to make a thing of it. And if I go to a startup and the person that I was with, my Kubernetes friend left a couple of months before me. And, and I don't want to say that impact. I don't want to say that influenced my decision, but it definitely made me confident to take this step, go to a company, get more hands-on, get my certifications. And really,
it's a risk. Let's be honest. You're going from IBM, which is going to give you long-term security benefits, to a startup, and you have a brand new family. Mm-hmm. That's a big risk. So your friend being there and saying everything is stable, I think is hugely important.
Well, he went to another company, and but it kind of made, and he was 25 years with IBM. so you know, taking that step, it was like, yeah. So taking that step, but watching him take that step, it encouraged me to, you know, like be confident in my decision. But I went to the startup and did just that. And I don't regret it, because what I wanted to learn, I learned. The certification that I wanted to get, I got. And what ended up happening was I was contributing to the Kubernetes open source project, and I needed help with something on GitHub. To this day, I love GitHub. You know how you have, like, you see people who have those friends and it's like this hate-love relationship? That's like me and GitHub. It's like, no matter how much I love it, it's just something about these branches, cherry picking and all of this other stuff that just doesn't always stick with me. So back then, you know, somebody was getting on Zoom to help someone with something. It was like a recruiter, and I wasn't paying attention, but I said, hey, you know, I actually need help with that. So do you mind if I join the Zoom session? And they were like, come on. So we get in Zoom, you know, real comfortable, recruiters cool. They were all from VMware. I didn't know that neither. And you know, so I connected with the recruiter, we kept in touch. And a year later, he's like, I think I got the perfect position for you. And I said, well, I'm not in the market, you know, but I'm always open.
That's the best time.
Yeah, I'm always open to hear, you know, what you have to say. So that was it was with VMware, and it was in reliability engineering. Now, while I was in IBM Cloud, we did work with SRE. IBM had just laid off, not before I left, they had laid off the SRE organization. And so I was familiar with SRE. Mm-hmm. I was familiar with SRE, but, you know, I'd never taken on that role. And a lot of what, you know, I was doing, and this team was centered around, because it was after the Pivotal and Heptio acquisition, and they were like Kubernetes organizations. So my team at the time was made up of Pivotal and Kubernetes employees, and then you have me and some others that came into VMware, and we were responsible. We were looking at reliability engineering, not from this infrastructure on call perspective, but how do we look at the foundational aspects? So at that time, my manager was from Google, our VP was from Google, the director was from Heptio, and you know, Google is who started Kubernetes. Google is who started building the foundation for SRE. So my team at VMware is based around reliability and engineering, and was centered around this whole container orchestration. So that's how I ended up there. And then I'm like, oh my God, this manager is from Google. You know, I got caught up in the whole FANG thing. I'm like, he probably knows all of this stuff. And to be fair,
Heptio was the Google engineers that built it.
Right.
So
right,
you were with like the founding people.
Yeah.
Like, so like, game on.
Yeah.
Sign me up.
Yeah, like,
and you're going to pay me? And you're going to pay me?
You're going to pay me to do what I enjoy doing, and I'm going to learn some new stuff and hang out with some cool people. And my team was made up of young people like me. And the difference was, these young people, I don't know, that first team I was on was also special to me, because it was almost like this group of talented people. Everybody has something that they're different in. I think we were all competitive. And so it was a lot that went on that team, but we all challenged each other in a way. And then you have this VMware culture, you have this Pivotal, these Pivotal employees, that Pivotal is a company where the culture, I don't know what they do over there, but that culture is embedded in their employees. And I absolutely, when someone tells me they're from Pivotal, I'm like, yes, let's collaborate. Heptio, when it comes to Kubernetes, they know their stuff. Like, when I say know it, they know it. So that experience was a blessing. And I tell people I'm not even, you know, ashamed to say this. When I was at VMware, I felt like I put a pause on, you know I like Kubernetes. I know I like this stuff. And it was no longer what new technology I could learn. It was, who am I as a professional? How do I want to work? Not what are the company's values? What are my values? Who is it? You know, what direction? I do a lot of sidebar training and mentoring that I don't speak about. Well, how do I do this in a way that that I could gain more visibility? And VMware has like this beautiful culture and Pivotal kind of like ingrained. It wasn't hard to ingrain too much of the cultures together because the founding principles were very similar. But at VMware, it was more about, again, the universe shifted me in the direction of, who are you? Who is it that you want to be? Don't worry about the next technology. Don't worry about making more money. Don't worry about any of these things that you have been worrying about. Don't worry about what everybody else is doing. Who are you? So VMware is a very, very special, very, very special. So, and I use this analogy in another conversation. I was like, if you think of two parents, I'm like, I always think about like IBM is like when you think about the mom, the nurturing. How are you supposed to show up? You know, you look this way. You got to be considerate. VMware is more like the passive disciplinary. No, this is not what you, this is what you're going to do. And we're not going to make you do it, but you're going to be in this environment where it's going to force you to do these things. It's not about, you know, all of these other things that you're focusing. It's about focusing on yourself, and you're going to focus on yourself, and you're going to become a better person, whether you want to or not, because that's how our culture is built. So I always use that analogy because both companies are very, they're very special to me because in terms of development as a person, they offered me different things at different times. And those times were at the right point in my life where I needed that. So, and then, you know, we were just acquired by Broadcom in November. So that's been, you know, that's been interesting, but, you know, VMware has definitely left like a imprint on me. And it was like, well, if you want to get to this next step, you got to take a pause on this and you have to focus on this if this is where you want to be. So, and then having, I think you mentioned earlier, having that freedom to not be ashamed to want to do something outside of your daily, that ability to explore was what I needed. So
that this has got to be one of the most uplifting, positive stories I've heard working for one of these really large companies. I've always right. felt like you were, I've always felt like from a career, if you're not going to start your own business, you kind of, when you're young, you get into those startups, you go into that crazy, crazy world. But at some point, you want to land in one of these IBMs, VMware, Oracles, where you have that stability, you get to work on a whole bunch of different tech, and you kind of ride out your career. You can do that with Google and Microsoft as well, right? But mm-hmm. you landed in these companies early on, like really early on. I mean, I wouldn't even say you did a lot of startup. You started in government, which is a really big machine, but you found two big companies that could have felt like government mm-hmm. and they weren't. And you found that early on, and I think it's amazing. It's wonderful. And you're working on mm-hmm. current tech. I think sometimes people have this idea that if you work at a big company, you're working on tech from 10 years ago. I mean, you're working mm-hmm. on today's tech.
I think that summation is perfect. And, you know, so I'm like, I don't, you know, I especially at IBM, you run into those people who started when they were interns. And the coworker that I work with, I think everyone on my team, when I was in IBM Cloud, they were all there for over 10 years. Like everyone was there for, except for me, and they were all older. So being in the tech industry, I've enjoyed working with the older crowd because there was a part of me that was always insecure too, because I didn't take that route. So I wasn't as vocal as I should have been about the things that I'm working on. I'm, you know, I'm always off doing my my own thing at VMware, I learned, well, you need to vocalize these things so people do know all of what you're doing. And then in or if you want to move to that next step, you need to showcase it in a way where you're leaving an impression on someone that's trying to get to where you're trying to be. So I always say, you know, when you're looking to move up or out or whatever it is that you're doing, challenging yourself is going to be when you take inventory of who you are and you learn how to scale yourself in a way that impacts other people that are trying to move in your direction, and you try to minimize some of those roadblocks and challenges that you had in their path so that, you know, they can maybe get one step ahead of you or, you know, get to where you are, wherever it is that they want to go. So, you know, so I don't regret I think my road was more challenging. Like, it sounds good now, but in the time, you know, there was a lot of crying and stuff going on, because you're like, I just can't figure this out. But, you know, that's the beauty in things. So when I'm talking to younger people, it's like, well, I did that, and I'm gonna tell you, don't do that. Do this. Or, you know, I met this person, go talk to them because they have, you know, this level of experience or whatever the case. It's like you go through all of these things so that you can kind of mitigate other individuals from those experiences.
Unfortunately, some people have to make their own mistakes too. So sometimes mitigating it as much as telling them, well, this is going to happen, so just be prepared, mm-hmm. because I can't stop you. Mm-hmm. But
right.
But you know, sometimes you do see a train wreck and you have to stop the train wreck no matter what, right? Like, you'll experience that with your kids. Like, a lot of times it's right. You just want them to fall down. Sometimes, you know, that one's bad, so I'm going to be a pain in the ass this time. But yeah, it's nice mm-hmm. to be in a position to be able to right. have a culture where people listen to each other, I think is the most important thing. And that's what mm-hmm. I'm kind of getting at, that you learn to be in these cultures, and these companies learn to be cultures of listening to each other. How old is your daughter now?
She's six, and
she's six. Is she hurdling anything yet? I'm imagining she's going to be a hurdler. So
no,
buy those little hurdles right now. Start getting her. Get that leg up. Leg up.
she's a healthy mix of me and her dad. And I was actually concerned. Like, I would have loved like a little athlete or something like that. And she's showing no indication of wanting to participate. So I got her into like soccer, and somehow I ended up, you know, becoming one of the coaches, and I could get everybody's child on the field except for mine.
So you can't coach your own kids. You just can't coach your own kids.
So
you need an assistant.
Right. I'm learning to take that step back and let her figure out who she is. And I didn't participate in athletics. I ran around outside, but I didn't start athletics till I was in sixth grade. So her journey is hers, and my job is to help her figure out what that journey looks like, and then, you know, help her get to wherever it is that she wants to be. But I am happy that she is learning Scratch right now, and she doesn't always, you know, grasp everything, but she enjoys doing it, and she sees me on a computer, so she likes getting on her computer. And you know, and I'm happy with that. Whatever she wants to do, I'm just here to you know, help you tackle those challenges. That's it. It's not my journey, it's hers.
I have five kids with my first wife. None of them are doing anything related to tech. And I have two new kids now with my second wife. Well, I would say adopted, stepkids. I don't know what they're going to do either. But I always feel like everything passes a generation. So look at what your parents were kind of into, and there's a good chance that's what I see from my kids, right? It's like the grandparents sort of there. So it's always interesting. But she's got a lot of time. So the fact that she's already into it is good.
Yeah. So just enjoy it. Be a kid. And as much as, you know, like, my mom is a nurse, my grandma's, I have a lot of nurses in my family, so I thought that was what I was supposed to do. My mom and my uncle played basketball. I thought I was supposed to play basketball. And my mom actually forced me to choose one and to go with track because that was what I was good at. So, saying all of that to say, you know, it's her journey, and it doesn't matter what you think you're going to do. Life can absolutely steer you in a different direction. So you got to learn to take whatever lessons you can from different experiences, and then whatever it is that you take from it, take that and apply it to the next experience. That's really all you can do.
I love it. All right. We are like ridiculously out of time, but I had to get to the rest of this story because absolutely amazing. I really love it. I really appreciate you spending all this time talking to us about this. So if anybody wants to reach out to you after listening to the show, they maybe they have a question or something, and we'll put it in the show notes. What's the best way for somebody to reach out?
Addie's Mama 17 on Twitter or X, whatever we're calling it these days, and definitely on LinkedIn. I would say from a professional standpoint, I'm mainly active on those two platforms. So Alexandra McCoy or Addie's Mama 17.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, this is Bill Kennedy and Alexandra McCoy signing off from the On Labs podcast. We both hope to see everybody again real soon.